we're sort of going to have a conversation, sort of, between us, but we thought we'd introduce each other first. Shall I introduce you first?
Yeah, I'm quiet.
Being a Palestinian. I first met Rowan, I think it was 2006, in Jerusalem, or in Ramallah, one or the other, can't remember exactly.
At Al Hosh.
At Al Hosh, I think.
Yeah.
She was the founding director of Al Hosh, which is an art institution in East Jerusalem from 2006 to 13.
Yeah.
Quite a while. She's currently doing a PhD in Birmingham on the art, sort of the art institution in Palestine. And if actually I read exactly, it makes sense. Art institution, the politics of the contemporary Palestinian art scene, looking at the general scene and its relation and contributions to the shift in modes of production, aesthetics and connotations, as well as meanings of art in society with a prolonged colonial context. She was also one of the founding members of the Calandra International group as an individual and also as director of Al Hosh. She's produced publications on Palestinian art, monograph on Sliman Mansour, on Bashir Mahul, Palestinian women artists, a collective book on Palestinian women artists, Palestinian video art, and two. She was the curator for the Palestinian exhibition in Venice in 2013 called Otherwise Occupied, which featured the work of Bashir Mahul and Aissa Dibi, and also produced the catalogue for that. And then just this last year was the main curator, I would say, of Bashir's solo exhibition in Palestine, in Jerusalem, and in Birzeit, called Floating Free, and also the editor of the catalogue for that, and essay writer, written quite a few essays about things, and currently a researcher.
Yeah, trying to be.
In Birmingham. And also she lectured in Palestinian art history at the International Academy in Palestine, and Dar al-Kalima College in Bethlehem.
Thank you, Nicola.
And probably many other things too.
Quite a bit. Small things we always forget.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's how it's like. Thank you, Nicola. Thank you all for coming and accepting our invitation. And I'm very happy and pleased that the Mosaic Rooms invited me. This is a great pleasure for me to be here. I've met Nicola in 2006 when she came to visit Al Hosh when I was just a starting, terrified new director of this newly established art center. And since then, I would say Nicola is considered to be part of the Palestinian art scene in one way or another. She's always been around doing different things with the Palestinian art scene. Her background originally as an artist, her main professional aspect was started in the 1990s as an assistant editor for the Third Text, and she has written quite a lot, actually, reviews, articles. She contributed a couple of times for articles for Al-Hosh work. She has written two reviews of the Qalandia International, the second and the first and the second edition. There are actually copies of it in the bookshop here.
Just on interject on that, they were in this Third Text from last year. It was, I should say, one article about the two Qalandia International projects. But there are some reprints that are in the bookshop. If you would really like one, for £2 each, if you would like. It's just a general review of the Qalandia 2012 and 2014. Or if you have access to Third Text through your universities or internet access, this was last year in May, I think. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. But then probably her first interaction with Palestinian art was through the Brazier International Artist Residency, which she started in 1995 and ran through 2009 and invited quite a lot of artists. We're talking about something around 250 artist, almost every name I know, she Nicola mentioned that they were at one point at the, at this residency, and then following that, she was once in a residency in Jifna as part of Jifna workshop. She was also involved with Qalandia International, with Qattan Foundation, particularly as a curator, as a jury member for the Young Artist Annual Award several times. And and she curated actually a Palestinian solidarity exhibition, which was first shown here in the Mosaic Rooms as the opening show when the space opened.
That's fun.
Yeah, I think.
I'm like an insider in the Palestinian scene, but we've been very privileged to have known many people, know the institutions, know the artists, know the organisations, the people involved, and what goes on. So I feel, in a way, like I'm an outsider, but with inside access or inside knowledge, and Rowan's very much an insider, but currently outside.
Trying to be an outsider. Yeah, we thought that we will try to make this talk in the form of conversation, like going through several topics. Shall I start, Nicola?
Yeah.
And we thought, before going into Qalandia International, to give just a quick background on the cultural scene, the visual art scene in Palestine, and how it came to develop in the form it stands in today. And to a certain extent, it started relatively in the beginning of the 90s. Until quite a bit, we have perceived this change in the Palestinian art scene as an effect of the Oslo Agreement. So what happened is that after the Oslo Agreement was signed, there was this international agreement to support Palestinians to survive and establish foundation for a final resolution with the Israelis. So basically, taps of international fund just flooded the scene, not the cultural or the civil society, including the PA. The cultural scene actually was one of the poorest, but it did receive quite some fund that managed to get it established. So in that time, cultural organizations in the form of NGOs, in the form of non-governmental organizations, started to develop. The first that we can talk about is Al-Wasati in Jerusalem, and then there was Sakakini, Khalil Sakakini Cultural Center in Ramallah. And it was then followed by Al-Ma'mal, and then Qattan opened, and then a few other that we today we can look and actually try to see what's happening with the map of cultural institutions in Palestine. Going back to the first point, which was about our perception that this is an effect of Oslo, I think today we look back at it and we see it not only as an effect of Oslo, but as an effect of all the changes that were taking place in the world. So at the same time where these Palestinian NGO institutions, internationally funded, started to emerge in Palestine, similar spaces were also emerging in Amman, in Beirut, in Cairo, and in other major cities in the region. So it's kind of, Oslo was one of the things that contributed, but it was part of a regional and possibly a global trend that started to take place as part of the whole changes in the world in the post-Cold War setup. Today, looking back at the scene, I would make a very basic analysis that says we can define three forms of institutions. One that is internationally funded. Normally, they have short-term projects, sustainability always shaky, but they have huge ambitions and they do succeed to do lots of great things. with lots of critic on the side, but now we're talking about the good things. The second form of institutions is actually the ones that are, to a certain extent, I wouldn't really say self-funded, but they have their own funding mechanism that gives them more independency than those that who are completely dependent on international funds. So Kattan Foundation is an example. The Palestinian Museum, which is going to open in 3 days, is another example. And these organizations played quite a major role because of this power that they have, that they actually control what they want to do. And they, the power that they have, the financial capacity to maintain, to sustain themselves and to choose what they want. And so that explains why an important program like the Young Artist Annual Award managed to survive, to live actually, and to grow and to develop since the year 2000 until today, while other organizations started similar initiatives but could not manage to sustain them because of the financial limitations. And recently, just in the 2-3 years, I would say, there's a new trend actually of having commercial galleries, which we never had in Palestine before. Art was never a commercial commodity. Well, it's always is in a way, but there has always this romantic relation in a way that art is not a commercial commodity. Plus, neither the economical nor the political situation ever provided the ground to have commercial galleries that can actually live and sustain themselves. Not that today the situation allows, but today the openness to the world offers alternatives to creating a local market through channeling to other regional markets through their centers and positions, in particularly in Ramallah, there's where they are based. So now we can talk about also commercial galleries that have connections with auctions in Dubai, auctions in the Gulf, in Beirut, and even sometimes they get to other
well, this year,
places around the world.
For the first year ever, two of the Palestinian galleries were in Dubai, in the art fair for the
first time. Yeah, that's true. And 2 years ago, if I'm not wrong, I'm not sure if it was last year or the year before, Sliman Mansour's Jamal al-Mahamel, the Camel of Hardship, which is basically the most famous Palestinian painting that carries too much of symbolism, and it's part of the visual memory. I'm sorry we don't have an image for it with us today. Was sold for a record number to Palestinian art. But this is what in Dubai, in an auction in Christie's, I think it hit something like $250,000. I hope I'm not mistaken with the numbers. But this is becoming also a trend not only with Palestinian art. I mean, paintings by modernist Egyptian artists and Iraqi artists are really hitting very high prices, which not exactly was the case just 5 years ago. This is typically related to what's happening in the Gulf today, and it's with the creation of this mega institutions, cultural institutions, and seeing Dubai as a hub for possibilities of developing different markets for art and culture and so on. And after all, regardless we perceive art as a commodity or not, the artists want to sell because they want to find ways to live. So this track opened. What shall we?
Maybe a bit about the idea of. I guess one thing I'll say now is what we may not be actually talking about as advertised. I think it was advertised as we would be talking about this year's Calendar International with the theme of The Sea is Mine, which we will. But before we get to that point, there's a few steps to go through because we thought we should set a bit more of the background as to what the whole Calendar International project is. So that's kind of where we're going now. So I think the images you're looking at here is just a slideshow from the Calendar International 2012 and 14 of the various different artworks and events. Sorry, I'll curated this part.
Yeah.
So it's just a general slideshow for you to have an idea. We're not going to say anything specific.
Shall we start talking about Calendia?
Because I think we should say something.
I mean,
about
talking
Calendia.
About the cultural scene is a talk on its own. If we open that part, we will end up in a different place. But I can, while talking about how the Calendia International idea was developed, I can reflect on the different institutions that were part of its establishment. So I will reflect on my personal experience, particularly on it. So that was something, that was 2012, the first edition, right? So sometime around 2011, there were meetings across different directors of art institutions. So I remember once I was meeting with Jack Persekian, who's the director of Al-Ma'mal Institution. And Al-Ma'mal had been running an annual visual art international show, particularly in Jerusalem. That was challenging the whole idea of the gallery as a white cube and going out to the public and trying to engage more with the city on the urban aspect. So we were discussing the possibility of actually developing and expanding this into something that could be sort of a biennial in the international meaning of a biennial. And then at the same time, there were other discussions across other organizations. And what happened at that time is that Riwaq, which is strangely, this is what they also claim, that they come to complicate the cultural scene. They are an architectural organization. They work in the conservation of traditional architecture, but for some reason, they want to be part of the visual art scene. Well, I know the connection is there, but this is how we make fun of each other sometimes. So they have been also running what they call the Riwaq Biennial, which is which started as an idea through which art and architecture can work together to engage communities, particularly in villages where Riwaq were doing conservation and preservation of traditional architecture and creating some kind of questioning this relation between visual art and architecture and engaging communities in different ways and bringing in, allowing people to visit these villages also. So it's a two-way relation between. So Riwaq Biennale and the Jerusalem Show, also as part of this discussion among the institution, decided on that year to work together and to make it a combined activity rather than two separate activities. And once this happened, other organizations were also in this discussion, and then we came all together and we're like, why don't we do one big thing all together rather than spread out? And that was quite late because we were thinking of something in autumn, and I think the first meeting was in February. So that was literally mad. Like, how can anybody organize something that is an international sort of, you know, announce it like an international visual art event in just a few months? But yeah, we're crazy. That's how it is. So it was five institutions sitting on the table when we were like, yeah, let's do it. Let's see what can we do. So what we decided to do is that, given the limitations of the time we have and the madness of our approach, let's just do whatever we are doing. But rather than having it spread across the year, collect it in one period of time, and let's announce it under one title, and let's do together work out the whole media and publicity and the coordination, and do something on the side that talks about this idea. So that was it. The first year there was no theme for Qalandia International. What we decided is that we will all move our main activities into these 2 weeks, and we decided to call it Qalandia International, which was the weirdest thing, I think.
Rowan, you're missing a few points.
What am I missing? Remind me.
No, the huge significance of naming it Qalandia.
Yeah.
Which I think is, I don't know whose idea that was.
That was Mahmoud Abu Hashhash.
Was it?
Yeah, of course. I was on the table.
Because we don't know, we know some of you out there in the audience, but we don't know all of you, and we have no idea how familiar you are with the situation in Palestine. Qalandia, of course, is the checkpoint, the main checkpoint between Jerusalem and Ramallah, which is pretty a heavy place, I think we could say, where thousands of people cross every day, not from the West Bank into Jerusalem so much, but from Jerusalem into the West Bank, people coming to go to work, to go to school, to go to college, to see their family members.
It's also to go the shopping. Way to South West Bank. So and those going to Bethlehem and Hebron need to cross.
Yeah, and it's often the point of clashes between all the checkpoints, of course, the military checkpoints. It's often the point of clashes and is often closed, and Fridays get quite intense when people try to go to the mosque in Jerusalem to pray. So it's a very significant aspect of life for everybody, in all Palestinians. In so many ways, but it's more than that. It's the there was an international Jerusalem International Airport was right there, and when you come through the checkpoint from Jerusalem to go into Ramallah, if you look to your left, you'll see it behind a fence. But it's been closed for it's not been an international airport since
2000,
but before for that.
It was still used as an airport
until 2000.
Then
it became.
So until the second intifada broke, it was still used as an airport, but it was a local small airport, not by the Palestinians. It was managed by the Israelis and used by the Israelis. But you know, if you're traveling from, I don't think even like civilians were able to travel there through it until that time. But it was still used as an airport.
But before 1948, it was built by the British in the 30s, I think. And before 1948, it was used, for not by everybody. But
it was actually, I don't know when it was built. I don't want to go into information I'm not sure about. But during the Jordanian rule of the West Bank after 1948, so from 1948 until 1967, it was actually the only airport in Palestine. And it did have international travels to everywhere around the world, more or less. So it was the access of Palestinians to the world, in a way.
It has a significance as a kind of a point of international contact, now that the West Bank has become so, when I say closed, obviously it is closed.
It's an underestimation.
So there's many resonances and significances to choosing the name of Qalandia. It's also a refugee camp, right as you come through the checkpoints on the right hand side is a big refugee camp, the Qalandia refugee camp, no refugee camps are big in ground space, but they're big in population, and obviously very significant places. And it's also a village. Qalandia was, or is a village, still, that's divided now by the separation wall, right? Mm. The wall goes right through and separates parts of the Qalandia village from each other. So it was a very significant choice to choose that name.
It's basically, we felt that Qalandia, given that it's a name so popular today on the media, for the fact that it is a place for daily clashes and contact with the Israelis. But at the same time, we know it endorses so many layers. Like the Qalandia village is a Canaanite village. So we're talking about all these layers that make who the Palestinians today are, from this this very old history from the Canaanite period, we're talking 5,000 years ago, until the village that continued to be a Palestinian village, and then the refugee camp, and then today, and the fact that it is basically, it strangles, it's in the middle of the West Bank, so it strangles the West Bank completely, and then the bit in the north and the bit in the south, this is the only way for it to, and it is a nasty place, it is a nasty place, and it, to a certain extent, it does represent how oppressive and hostile and inhumane occupation is, and so many people died on that checkpoint. So many women had birth in cars on that checkpoint. Many people died in ambulances on that checkpoint trying to cross. So it does hold so many different things: feelings, history, memories. I was traumatized from that checkpoint for so long because it was a place of daily clashes, and during the second intifada I had to cross it every day when there was live shooting going on, so we had to run between the cars. So I stayed traumatized from that place for like 10 years. It was just until recently that suddenly I remembered that I don't get heartbeats as I come close to Colombia. It just went away. Yeah, well, yeah, I got over it. I don't remember when, but yeah, it took me maybe 10 years. Every time I was approaching Colombia, I would be shaking and my heart would be beating so fast because it's such a traumatic place. So it's Colombia International.
Yeah. So yeah, another point of the bringing together of all the organizations was that bringing together, because it was the idea of bringing the, because things have become so separated and it gets difficult to move around and difficult to see people and communicate, the idea was to bring all the organizations that together to try to produce something together. That was one of the main points. And then the international was to also to try to take it out to the world, to bring other artists there to be involved, and also to create a kind of an international profile for an event happening there, in a way that perhaps many people are not aware of what goes on in the cultural and visual arts scene in Jerusalem and Ramallah, and also in the cities of Haifa and Nazareth and Gaza, of course. So that was another aim, was to really create an international profile to try to...
But for me also, using the name, it's a way of re-owning the name in a way, because it was stolen from the whole... because it represents a place, and the place is the first thing we lost as Palestinians. So giving it to an event as such is our approach to re-own the name and give it its own connotations in a different way, because this is, although it represents all these ugliness and traumatic, but it's also this place that has so many layers, and if we dig down deep, we can find a lot of things to tell our stories through, and to remember, and to invent, and to imagine, and...
Yeah, so there's a lot. It's not just an art event by any means. And also, this is something Rowan and I both learned this last couple of weeks from communicating with the teams in Palestine about what their plans are for this year. They're not calling it a biennale, which is how it was advertised in the first instance. But there's been a very conscious decision by all the partners involved that it's not a biennale. It's biennial, but it's not a biennale. Quite specifically, I think they've made that conscious choice to not call it a biennale, in order to differentiate it from all the other biennales that take place around the world, because it is obviously quite different in its way. Covered that one.
Yeah, let's talk about the second edition.
Yeah, the first.
The first edition. We haven't completed the first edition.
No, we haven't.
So the first edition Okay. The five organizations who were on the table agreeing to go ahead with this mad idea were actually Al-Ma'mal Foundation, Al-Qatta's. I'm giving just the short names of these organizations because everyone is like five words. So I'll just give the short names.
I'm just going to stop this.
So it's Al-Ma'mal, Al...
Men?
Yeah.
Try escape.
Yeah.
Okay. There's the other one.
Can I help you from here?
Is anyone familiar with Kino? Come on,
look. It's like the room. Page behind that when you've got less, so you can go across and just click on the one that's behind it.
I'm not controlling my clicks. I just wanted to get the poster for 2012. Men?
Yeah.
Can we get that second?
The second.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's just
is that it?
Yeah, that's it.
I just thought we'd have the poster for the 2012. Just here. Which did have a theme. Art and life in Palestine. It was a very, very general.
Yeah. We want to cover it. So anything that went under that theme would work. Is it working now? Is it on?
No, we click now.
You click? Okay.
Yeah. So we're going to leave this one for a minute.
All right. So the first edition, which is Qalandia International, Life, Art and Life in Palestine, was the first edition that every organization did just what they were doing, but made it in the same period of time. And the five institutions who founded the Qalandia International were Al-Ma'mal, Qattan Foundation, Al-Hosh, the museum, the Palestine Museum. Just a second, here they are. So it's Al-Qattan, Al-Hosh, Al-Ma'mal, International Academy of Art, Palestine, and Riwaq. These five organizations actually founded it, and on the first year, a few other organizations came on board as partner venues mainly, and over 2 weeks we featured different activities, exhibitions, talks, public events, and public performances. And the Yaya has become, which is the Young Artist Annual Award, has become the a main event that happens every edition of Qalandia International. And on the second edition, the thing that we were all the time discussing is how does this event connect, since there's no overarching theme. It's basically just a cluster of activities taking place in different places. And based on that, of course we did that because of the limitation of time, but based on that we thought that for the second edition we will start introducing themes that are also wide enough that can endorse different ideas, but at least then each edition a theme can be explored through and interpreted and articulated by each organization. On the second edition, the theme was archives lived and shared. So the archive was the main theme. And again, it was taken by every organization and articulated and interpreted in a different way. And every organization came with its own statement about the archive and tested it, explored it in different ways. So there was the Yaya, there was the Jerusalem Show, there was Al-Hosh, and there was the Palestine Museum, and there was the activity, Manam, which is in Haifa. So in the second edition, there were seven main partners that joined in the group sitting on the table. And one of the things that I missed saying is that one of the criteria is that the organization work together to pull in resources to support. So every organization brings in, there's a specific amount of money that every year each organization will pitch in, and this pool of money will cover bringing in international media, doing the international, doing the marketing and the advertising and the poster and the coordinator and the website and all these things. So this was also a way of how can we work collaboratively to overcome this financial limitations and restrictions. And shall we start with this new coming edition? Do you want to add anything about the past editions?
I think I was just thinking, saying maybe a few more points about the choice of this theme. Perhaps the first one, like Art and Life in Palestine, is a little bit general and a bit kind of like, well, this is us showing ourselves to the world. This is, you know, we want to show the world that, you know, we have a cultural life and there is a visual artist here. The archive, lived and shared theme, I think, was partly, I'm not quite entirely sure of this, but I think it was partly because the Palestine Museum was involved for the first time.
Yeah.
And the Palestinian Museum opens next week, actually. It's been a fraught project that's been in the planning for a long time. About 30 years in general, overall.
Mm-hmm.
20 to 30 years.
Yeah, something like that.
And it's finally being open. The building has been opened next week.
Yeah. And an exhibition in Lebanon.
And a lot of research was done into, well, what does a Palestinian museum mean? How can we have a museum when we have no Palestine? And how can we have a museum when there's nothing to put in it? Because we don't know where it is, and it's all separate, what's the word? Not distributed, you know what I mean? Dispersed and stolen and taken by people. So, but what people do have is their own personal. They have personal things, they have personal possessions, they have photographs, they have memories, they have stories. So that was partly behind the idea of the archives theme. And it was, I think it was a theme that a lot of the institutions generally have been thinking about. It's a problem with the art, with the visual art. Like, there is no place where, there is no Tate Museum, there is no National Gallery, there is no place where art lives on a permanent basis. It's only in, most of the artists still own a lot of their work. It's shown in certain situations, and there's been definitely a focus a lot on the young, on younger artists in recent years, and less so perhaps on the older generation artists. And where is their work? Where is it? Is it, some of it's been destroyed, some of it's in Beirut, some of it's been lost in fires, some of it's in Jordan. A lot of it we don't know. So I think that the idea of the archive was a crucial one. And it was explored in different ways by the different projects and organisations. The Jerusalem Show, for example, as part of this Kalandra International, was curated by Turkish curator Başak Senova. And she didn't deliberately take on the idea of archive as things in a collection or in a museum, but she worked with the idea of Jerusalem itself, the actual place being an archive of sorts, of obviously of histories, memories, everything, of so many things. So each institution had its own interpretation of the theme, and I think it produced some pretty interesting results. I mean, Al-Hosh, for example, where you used to be, did actually kind of a strange combination of... it was because it was very immediately after the Gaza War in 2014, which I'm sure you remember, was some very heavy bombing of Gaza for two to three months. Gaza was virtually almost destroyed
I don't know percentages, but I think we can say quite a large percentage, obviously, of lives, but also buildings, infrastructure in general. And so Al-Hosh in Jerusalem had put on had an exhibition of work related to Gaza in different ways.
I think, yeah, also one of the interesting projects on the second edition, an organization from Kuwait was also a partner, which is Masharia Min Rossi, and Ala actually curated this exhibition about the Palestinian memory in Kuwait, which was also very, very important to touch upon the memory of Palestinians in diaspora, especially in places where their memory is sort of forgotten because of political changes, got them in Kuwait and then got them tragically out of Kuwait. And then there's this period where they have done so many things and contributed is sort of forgotten in a way. So that was quite important to look upon it as part of this history. Well, other archives are also still completely forgotten in a way between Beirut and Tunis and Amman and Athena and Cyprus. And
So it did. It was a key theme in many, many ways. The Young Artists Award, curated by Italian curator Viviana Cecchia, not sure how to pronounce her name. The Young Artists is a slightly different project than the other organisations in that they're young artists under 30, and they produce works very specifically for the Young Artists Award and awarded prize money. And this was the first time that there was a theme based around the idea of the archive. And, for example, two of the artists explored the Palestinian art history as an archive, and Palestinian artists. I think she was the first prize winner, Noor.
No, it was Bashar.
Bashar was
Bashar
the first.
Who...
Yeah, both the first and the second.
But they both
explored that. I'm thinking of Noor, the second one. She produced a whole work where she went deep into the research into Palestinian artists of the generation who are now in their sort of 60s and 70s. Your father, for example, is one of them, right?
Yeah.
And produced a very interesting work because this information is not there. It's not there to be found. So it was like an inventive, not inventive in the sense that the artists were inventive, but it was kind of an invented story, looking at the... who are these artists? Where are they? Where did they go? Where is their work? What did they do? What were their names? Where did they live? What did they do? So, it produced a lot of interest.
And that was actually important because at the beginning of this talk, I was talking about this turn of the institution, but I didn't say what was before this turn in the institutions. And this is this is another period that's completely forgotten, which is pre-1995 in a way, where artists, to a certain extent, we can say they worked individually, they were motivated personally or collectively as part of the national discourse. And they worked together under the umbrella of the Palestinian Artist League, which was affiliated with the Palestinian Union of Artists, which worked under the PLO. So there was an institution involved in the process, but the part that was particularly in Palestine, its affiliation was always discreet. They were not allowed to announce their affiliation with the PLO. But that was a completely different setup of the relation between the artist and the institution and how the institution offered spaces or opportunities or possibilities for the art to nurture. And on the turn of the 90s, this generation was, to a certain extent, I wouldn't say forgotten, that would be too harsh, but it was marginalized. They stood on the side, and then there was this explosion of contemporary art and new medium and new ways of expression that kept them on the side in a way. They were not anymore part of the scene in exhibition. They were rarely in exhibitions unless they would organize them as solo exhibitions. And so going into the archive and looking at that part was quite important.
So we'll, I think we'll go into moving to 2016, which...
Can I ask
sure.
What are the visitors for these exhibitions? Are they all Palestinians, or do they come from the other side as well to visit?
Which other side?
To see the exhibitions. I mean, the Israeli side.
No.
They don't.
Well, Israelis officially are not allowed to go into Palestine because it's a dangerous area for their lives. So if they go, they will be persecuted by their own government. So let's start from this point. Second, they don't come for different reasons. Legal, moral, because barriers are there in different forms, physical barriers, non-physical barriers. They don't come. When I was working in El Hosh, we used to get some Israeli visitors, mainly those from the left side, but very, very rarely. And
we can have a discussion later about this part, but it's this. They don't know about it, or very unlikely that they don't even know about it, because it's not in there. I don't know who I mean by there, but it's not in that society.
It's not publicized for the Israeli community. It's not publicized in the Israeli media. Those who are interested will look for it. If it's in Jerusalem, they would probably come if they have the courage to do that, because. You know, but in the West Bank, it's the chance is very, 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 very little. Maybe the only Israeli who would be there is Amira Haas, who's an Israeli journalist who lives in Ramallah, because she's totally aware of this relation between Israelis, between the occupation and the Palestinians. She's speaks quite. Honestly and bravely about the Palestinian case.
But to answer your question, the audience is it depends. It depends where, because the projects take place in all around in Jerusalem, in Ramallah, in Haifa, in Nazareth, in Gaza, in some of the villages around in the West Bank villages. So the actually tours are organised to take people around. Different venues, and the audiences there's international media to a certain extent is part of the audience. Interested people who know about people, I say people like me, but people who know about the situation there and the people there and are involved in it in some ways anyway. The artists and their own circles, if you like. The Ramallah itself has a very big cultural society, if you like, that goes to many different things. So it's quite there's a large cultural society, I'll say. And in the villages, it's actually the people who live in the village as well. So there's a very good conscious effort is made to involve people in the villages in the processes, in either in some of the actual projects themselves or in workshops. There is very direct involvement with the community, if you like, or different communities.
Well, a positive thing about Palandia International, because to be fair and honest to ourselves, I mean, Ramallah, yes, it does have its vibrant cultural scene, but it is, to a certain extent, just like London, but you need to work the proportion out. It does have its own circle of people who are interested in visual arts or in cultural scene, and they, as Nicola said, it does not necessarily integrate all parts and all people of the community, but that's how it happens anywhere else in the world. In Jerusalem, but outside Columbia International, it seemed much harder to bring in people and to drive their interest. With an event with this size, with the fact that all the organizations work together and put in their different resources, whether financial or, you know, people and capacities, different forms of capacities, we succeeded to have a much bigger interest. So, yes, if we compare other activities, like single exhibitions outside Qalandia International and the same single exhibition inside Qalandia International, we would be talking about a huge difference in the amount of audience who would come. And yes, it would be locals, it would be international curators or media and internationals who are there, it would be the artists and their circles. But I think that was part of the success of the Qalandia International. It did succeed to bring in more people because it is such a big event in Palestine.
And a lot of the organisations for many years have been making very conscious efforts to have international connections with other groups, with individuals in the other Arab countries, wherever they can, wherever possible. There's been many links made between different filmmaking groups, artist groups, NGOs, the whole structure, if you like, of society.
A question about, you mentioned there were events or exhibitions in Gaza. Could you talk about the challenges you face given the Egyptian and Israeli government restrictions on entry Gaza, both from an organisation and population perspective? And of course,
how about, can we leave that?
I was just thinking.
What do you want to talk about now?
Yeah, since this question was raised, okay, why don't I talk about what the Gaza organizations are doing for this Qalandia International? So we will cover this part, and then
I will just say,
why don't you just introduce the third edition?
Okay,
talk about the concept.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. But if we briefly introduce this 2016 version, then what we say about Gaza will actually make more sense. Or we'll actually mean
totally
a bit more.
Yeah.
I will just tell you that the in the 2014 version, it's very much, because I'm sure you know about the separation of West Bank and Gaza and not being able, you know, people not being able to go from one to the other and the people not being able to leave Gaza either way, whether it's through Egypt or into the West Bank. But there's a lot of contact between the artists in Gaza and the cultural organisations, but there's two very specific groups in Gaza of artists. One called El Tikar and one called Shababik, which just means windows, right?
Windows and meeting.
They're both very strong groups of artists who generate. I think they've been given houses by the Ministry of Culture to use as bases, as studios, and they work very, very hard at doing their own things because they know where they are, they know their situation, they are quite phenomenal in what they do for themselves. I shouldn't say nobody goes there, but there isn't the international media don't go. The only easy way to get into Gaza is with an NGO, and even that's not easy, so easy now. But they organise their own things, and they have their own audience, I would say, I think.
Shall we talk about This Sea Is Mine?
Can I just
start?
Oh, do you want to start?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I just want to say, and then you can go on from this.
Okay.
It is, obviously, it's a very interesting theme. It is directly taken from a poem by Mahmoud Darwish called Mural, which I read on the train coming into London this afternoon. It's a very long poem. It's on Facebook. If you just Google Mural, Mahmoud Darwish on Facebook, and it comes, the line comes at the end. and it blew me away, I would say. So I would just say read it. I don't know why it's called Mural. Why is it called Mural? Didn't make sense to me why it's called Mural.
I think because it was too long from one.
Maybe.
And from another point, it was something between poetry and nathar. What is nathar? Prose.
Yeah, it's a
so
prose.
It's
a prose poem, I guess. It's very long.
And it's a reflection of his period. He got sick at one point, and he was hospitalized, and he was going from conscious to unconscious, and he basically thought he was dying, but then he survived it. So a large part of this was his hallucinations between these two phases, and it's a fantastic piece of poetry.
Yeah.
So yeah.
But there's more. There's much more to the selection of the using the thief. This seer's mind, which I will leave to you.
Yeah. well, this seer's mind. The main theme that the Qaland. The thing that I would like to mention first is that this is the first year that neither me or Nicola has been directly involved with the Qalandi International because we are here this year. So we have been trying to... Luckily, we are connected with all the people responsible. So we tried to get as much as possible from the discussions that went through in order to understand how the concept developed. It started with a notion of return, which is basically they describe it. It became sort of the word that would offer the magical cure for the Palestinian tragedy. But their articulation of it was that, however, this seems quite unrealistic because what the Nakba as a tragedy has put over the Palestinian people is not something that will be cured only by the return. That's from one point. From another point, that return as a term has been deprived of its meaning, of its personal meaning, to people who have been dispossessed, displaced, and have been yearning to come back to their houses, to their home, to their homeland. And it has been reduced to symbols that became, to a certain extent, meaningless in their iteration and mentioning them by every politician going on a platform and talking about the national project, which obviously has failed. The revolutionary national project of the PLO is a failure, as we see today, to be frank with ourselves. So it became something very superficial, the whole dealing with the return. It became these symbols of the map and the key and the yearning for the olive groves and the orange groves of Jaffa and so on and so forth. So plus they were also looking at what was happening today in the world, and particularly what's happening in Syria, and the fact that all this displacement that the Syrians are suffering is sort of re-seeing the whole Palestinian tragedy in contemporary day. And the idea was that there is a necessity, that there is an urgency for the day, for the moment that we're living today, to look at the term of return and understand what it means for people who has been displaced 68 years ago, and for people who are now actually facing this trauma of displacement, are being drowning, trying to seek refuge in Europe and drowning in the Mediterranean, or ending up in refugee camps in Jordan or Lebanon or Turkey. So it all came about from this, but they were also aware that it is important to take the term from a critical point, so as not to be handled and dealt with the same superficiality that the politicians today handle and use the term in every occasion. And they chose "The Sea is Mine." The sea is mine because it comes from it's a verse from Mahmoud Darwish's poem, but because the sea has been the vessel, in a way, which took people out of Palestine. People were displaced. In addition to walking to wherever they walked, to Jordan Valley, to Gaza, or to Lebanon, huge amounts of them were actually using the sea, taking boats to Lebanon or to Gaza. So the sea was a way to be displaced, but also the sea is this open gate to the world, which is today closed. The only sea that is open to Palestine is that of Gaza, which even the Gazans, they don't own for so many reasons. It's not a space for opening up to the world. It's another form of closure. It's another barrier, in a way. They are not allowed, it does not open them to the world. They are not allowed to benefit from it for economy, because they are not allowed to fish except for a certain distance. So the sea seemed like the meaning, the notion that can endorse, in a way, meanings of return. I will just read a little bit from their statement, because yeah. I think they've articulated quite well. And so they say, the sea, which has inadvertently been omitted from our narrative and the agendas of our politicians, and subsequently been transformed into another component of the siege, or a trap for those fleeing death, could potentially elevate the question of this right from the possibilities of politics in the realm of obviousness. It may be able to position Palestine and Palestinians in the rightful historic and geographic place and enable us to reclaim our organic ties with the future and the world. So this was actually the angle from which they presented it. But the thing is, this is just a very general theme, and every organization, every partner has the full freedom to re-articulate it, to reinterpret it. So, and in this edition, there are, first edition, 5 organizations, second edition, 7 organizations, this edition, there are 13 organizations on board. So it is, the whole Columbia International is expanding. And each one of them that we have succeeded to speak to, although they are in the very, very initial preparations and things are not yet clear, but have succeeded in presenting a different articulation of the theme and presenting very interesting ideas.
I would just also say one of the most sort of not poetic exactly things of choosing the theme of the, it's not the theme of the sea, but to use the sea in there, is that, I mean, you now have in the West Bank, you have a generation of young people who have never been to the sea, mm-hmm. even though it's half an hour away, and there's certain points in the West Bank where you can see it in the distance, but they've never been. They cannot actually access it because they're not allowed. So I think that's also no one's directly engaged with that in the programs. But I think because for everybody there, that's one of the obvious things. So for them,
artists have
yeah, there are artists
worked too. On the theme of the sea, and they're
done.
Sharif.
So because the project is not happening until October, and really all that's been released so far is this image and a press release about the theme. We've been communicating with the last couple of weeks quite intensively on Skype chats and emails with all the organisations, trying to find out what is everybody planning to do for this year's Kalandia International. And of course some of the responses were like, what? It's only May. We don't know. Well, certainly nothing absolutely very specific, but everybody has, there are plans. And so we'll just perhaps now tell you about some of those plans. Where are we going to start? That's the list of the this year's partners. It's extending out to Beirut, a new organisation in Beirut called Dar al-Nimr, which is opening next week with the satellite exhibition for the Palestine Museum on embroidery. I think it's a new, as far as I know, it's a new place.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's, do you know anything about it? How long?
I know that it's a new place.
You know it's a new, we all know it's a new place. We don't know what else. Any new organisations joining are, I guess that's, you know, Dar al-Nimr maybe.
Yeah, Dar al-Nimr are the new, and Shabib, Kriwak, Ramallah, Mishpati, they've all been there except for Dar al-Nimr and Dar, which we don't have it here, yeah. Which is the decolonizing architecture. Our cultural association, yeah, the rest have been there. Birzeit University hasn't been there, so this is the first time also.
Oh, we thought we'd give you a map. This map is actually from the 2012 version, Art and Life in Palestine, which just gave an idea of where the different events were taking place, including Amman, which is off to the over here. But just to give you an idea of the where the events were taking place.
And Beirut way up there.
And Beirut above it. This was the only visual that we managed to get from anybody for this year. And this is the project of the Ramallah Municipality, which I have a big problem saying municipality, so I will say Ramallah Town Council.
They won't be happy, but they don't know. Yeah.
If you can imagine...
They're a city. If you call them a town, they will be really upset.
Okay, city. City government. For some reason, I have a big problem with municipality. But that's essentially what it is. It's Ramallah Council.
Yeah, it is a
Ramallah Council. Do you want to say about their project?
Yeah, you go ahead.
They have been the most, perhaps... advance prepared. They put out a call based on a title, Sites of Return, put out a call for artists, filmmakers, writers, activists to engage with Ramallah municipality sites. And they have various projects from various artists, some a mixture of Palestinian and others. It's curated by an American architect, actually, who's based in Cairo, called Beth Stryker, in collaboration with a Palestinian curator, architect,
yeah.
Sahar
Kawasmi. Yes, Sahar Kawasmi.
And it's they've had some interesting... This is all we can tell you now, because it's all, obviously, in plan. They've had some very interesting... proposals from artists, including building a pigeon tower in the old Ramallah Centre, which is a project by the Palestinian artist Nida Sinokrot. And of course, the idea of the pigeons is that they go away when they come back, and I think the pigeons are going to have lights on. So the idea is that there'll be pigeons with lights on, flying out in the morning and coming back at night.
Near the sunset, yeah.
Huh?
And sending
messages, possibly. Another artist is also has a project which is messages. Reem Al-Khadi, who's an Iraqi-American artist, also has a project about messages. And she's going to be working with some of the communities in the villages, which she's done before. And she'll do workshops with people in the villages, and they'll be writing letters, but on their clothing, on their shoes and clothing, and so they'll be almost like hidden letters. Stories unbounded by geography and time is the way it's presented. There'll also be some projects in the... There's two refugee camps actually right in the centre of Ramallah, Kadura and Amri. And there are groups who will be doing some projects in the refugee camps, growing what they were called
forests,
food forests, creating food forests in the camps. And there's not much space in refugee camps, but what space there is going to be used to try to grow some food in some way. Don't know quite how exactly. But if you are familiar with any refugee camps, that image itself is quite a powerful image of anything growing in a refugee camp, particularly in an open space outside. So that would be interesting to see. Another group are working with families of martyrs and prisoners in probably most in a lot of the refugee camps. Those who are imprisoned with Israeli jails, because there's many prisoners in Israeli jails who are some are sentenced. There's children in Israeli jails who have never been sentenced, and it's a constant struggle for the families of when their family members are going to return. So this is another twist on return, which is a very close return. It's about your family members who are in prison, Israeli jails, and when will they return? So this group of activists is doing some project with the families of prisoners and people who've died too. And that's all we know generally. And I think the municipality itself, I managed to say it then, municipality. There's a plan to organise an exhibition of some actual artworks by some of the older generation artists, such as Sliman Mansour, Nabil Anani, Taysir Barakat, Ismail Shamout, who did many works in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, very specifically about return, about the Palestinian return, because it was it's still a huge issue, but for them it was a very big issue. And many of the imagery in their actual works is very consciously about return. So that would be... Actually, I think that would be quite interesting, because that would be a very specific local project, if you like, but a very important one that I think needs... Because these paintings are not available to be seen. They're not on show. So that would be... In my view, that's quite a radical...
We have 7 minutes.
...move.
We have 7 minutes.
Oh, do you? Okay, next. The Young Artists Award is the project that I've been closely involved with. This year has been curated by Dutch curator Nat Muller. And she is also at the point of having put out a call for applicants. And she's treated the theme in a more formal way. If you can read of that, I'm not going to read it all, but with ideas of repetition, recurrence, patterns, rhythm, rehearsal, movement as form and imaginary. And she's asked the artist to be as imaginative as they can about their proposals, because that's the point that they're at in this project, is making proposals for work that's not yet made, but will be made by October.
Shall we move on to the...
This is a project that's planned by Rewark, the architectural renovation organisation. Again, we don't know specifics, but it's going to involve photographs of Jaffa Gate at the old city of Jerusalem by a photographer called Eric Mattson, who is an American-Swedish photographer who lived in Jerusalem from 18-something or other till, I think, 1946, and documented many things in Palestine. But you told me something interesting about the Jaffa Gate.
It was my interpretation, in a way, of how I saw this project connects with the sea is mine and with the idea of return, because Jaffa is a city that, mentioning the return, is always connected with Jaffa. Jaffa has this memory or we embed this memory of loss that is connected particularly with Jaffa, which was a very vibrant cultural and economic city, and it was the potentiality of its growing in the future of this region was completely lost. So it didn't only lose its presence and its past, it lost its potentiality for the future. So looking from Jaffa Gate towards Jaffa, so there's this lost sea, this yearning for return, and this reflection from images that are from before 1948, and this whole movement of tradesmen and family and social connections between Jaffa Gate and Jaffa, the city. So this is, I thought this was how they connected to the theme.
So we don't know specifically what you'll see if you do go in October, but it will be something related to that. And we'll go to Gaza now.
Yeah.
Answer your question. We had a Skype conversation a few days ago with two of the artists in Gaza, which I thought we would show you here. And it was all in Arabic, so I will have to ask Rowan to tell you exactly
I'll try to make it short, because I think we only have now 3 minutes. So we chose this image because this is how we always communicate with our Gaza colleagues and peers. And
the electricity went out as we were talking to them.
Yeah, so the Shababik and Iltiqa are two... are spaces, but are also spaces made from artist collectives. So Sharif and Andra, each of them represent one of these spaces, and they are adopting the theme from Qalandia International as it was presented. And for them, it is very, very important and sensitive because they live on the sea, which they can't really reach, they can't really own in a way. Actually, most of the refugees in Gaza, which Gaza endorses the highest population per meter square in the world, that's one. And second, it has the highest number of refugees in one place. And most of the refugees in Gaza came from villages that were depopulated and probably destructed across the Palestinian shore, from Jaffa down to Gaza. So their connection with the sea historically has been a connection of life, of economy, of way of earning their living. It's not only about the open, beautiful image of the sea. It's how they made their life make sense. And now they have lost this the first time when they were depopulated and displaced from their villages. And now they're losing it again because they cannot access the sea, which is basically, you know, two steps out of their doorhouse. What the two groups have done is that they have invited 13 artists, 8 men and 5 women, to present projects within this theme. They still don't know what project to expect, but we have tried to discuss with them where they think they will present and what kind of hardships they would face. So they were thinking that going out of their spaces would be great, particularly going to the sea. But they mentioned a few things that are again, you know, reaffirms this whole paradox of the fact that you own the sea is there, but you cannot own it. The thing is, in Gaza, they cannot actually do any cultural activity outside their spaces without getting a permission from the Gaza government. So it's not only the relation with the Israelis. And Gaza government, to give a permission for a cultural activity to take place is a very complicated issue. The other thing, if they want to show on the sea is actually, a huge portion of it is populated, it's polluted by sewage water. So it's not
so
in
they
any
cannot,
way...
they cannot even go into the sea.
It's not in any way accessible. You cannot do anything. You cannot fish, you cannot swim, the smell is horrible, so it's... That's one. The bits that are clean and are useful, actually, the government rents them out to private companies over summer to make cafes and restaurants in them. So the public cannot access them because only people who can afford to actually sit in a restaurant and buy food and coffee and argile to go there. So the sea is stolen from them again in so many different ways. They've lost it the first time, they've lost it the second time. Israel does not allow them to fish except for a very limited distance. It's polluted. The clean parts is actually sold for private sector again. These were really the bits they were talking about, plus the hardship of going into the public space and showing to in the public space. That's mainly what we discussed, and we're hoping to know more from them once they receive their project proposals from the artist. The other project that I would like to talk about, because I think it's very, very interesting, is actually the DAR. DAR is an organization or a residency. I don't know how they define themselves. They are a program called Decolonizing Architecture Art Residency, and it's a program developed by two architects, Sandy Hilal and Alessandro Petti, and they were invited to become a partner for Qalandia International, but they said no. They said no because they did not see themselves as an institution, and they didn't see themselves relevant sitting on a table of institutions. So they accepted to be invited as guest artists contributing to this partnership in different ways. And their being in this edition is very relevant for many reasons. Alessandro and Sandy has been 4 years working on the whole, working particularly with refugees in refugee camps. And their main approach is that the camp has been neglected, ignored, and dealt with as a temporary place for the past 68 years. In the past 68 years, there have been generations being born and lived and grown in refugee camps. And these spaces are completely disregarded. They're considered as if they do not exist. And nobody has actually thought, in a way, of what's going to happen to the refugee camp when people get actually the to return, if it ever happens, or if it's as a concept possible. So Alessandro and Sandy, their approach is actually very, very interesting. They think that the refugee camp is a very important component of the Palestinian history and memory, and it needs to be properly positioned and remembered within this narrative of the past 70 years. So what they do is to try to re-look at our image of the refugee camp and look at the architecture in a way that, rather than dealing with it as a space that I don't want to connect with and I need to leave, but as a space that is actually contributed to building up the whole national discourse and contributed to who we are as Palestinians today. So why not be proud of it? Why not look to make it a more livable place than keeping it as the media presented, as the miserable, poor, overpopulated place, which in fact it is, but there are potentials. If architecturally and from the point of view of our architects and urban planners and artists involved, the potentiality of making a change in the place is possible. This is for me the very interesting approach of Sandy and Alessandro. And what they have done is, this is actually a school for girls in Shafat refugee camp, and they designed it in a way that is more open. Maybe the image here doesn't really show how their approach, but it's designed as pentagons that connect with each other, creating among them a lot of small spaces where people can actually collect, assemble, sit and talk and discuss. There's a lot of greeneries. Students are involved in planting and making the place work. So this will be part of this project will be presented as part of the Qalandia International in different ways. There will be a couple of installations taking place here. There will be a visit to it, and there will be discussions around the whole idea of refugee camps and their role in making the Palestinian today and in the memory and the narrative of the Palestinian. And They will also be contributing with two other installations, one that will go in El Hosh to tell the story of this. The installation, I mean, I don't see it makes sense that to go into description of it, but it's basically about stories of people in the school and what the school means to them. And there's another installation that is narrating memories of people from the Haitian refugee camp, where Dar is actually situated.
Maybe while we have this image, we can just say a quick word about the Jerusalem show.
Yeah.
The Jerusalem show is the other sort of larger main project of in the Calandia programs, organized by the Al Mama Foundation in the Old City. And this year they're going to be using two sites rather than the range of sites around the Old City that they've has usually been done in the past. They're going to use the... It's an Australian curator called Vivian Zihel. And it's they're going to be using the Shawafat Refugee Camp, which you see in the background here. They're going to be using the Youth Centre, which is next to this school, I understand, as a venue, an exhibition venue. So it's the first time that there's going to be a real exhibition organised in the camp. And then they're using the Al Mamal building. And Vivian's theme is before and after origins. And it's part of a project, a larger project, that she's starting now, actually, in Australia, called Frontier Imaginaries. And it's, there'll be artists from Palestine and the Golan Heights, from South Africa and the Netherlands. And her project is all of... It's about... It's because in Jerusalem, the issue is not so much about return, it's about staying. It's about reclaiming, but staying in Jerusalem, because there's so many moves, obviously, made to get as many Palestinians out of Jerusalem as can be done. So in Jerusalem, the issue is about staying. And her
and is waving for me from there.
We could go on for like another 5 hours. But that's roughly what's going to be the Jerusalem show, as far as we know.
There are a couple of other organizations and projects, but yeah, we don't have time to go through them.
No.
Plus, their projects are still very in the very early initiation. So,
but we wanted to finish with this image, just as a fun image. This is a project by the Dao organization called Concrete Tent.
It's a concrete tent.
I think it's in Dahisha camp.
Yeah.
In Bethlehem. And I think they're going to be doing some projects for Calandia International. These tents, they've already done, they already exist.
Yeah.
But they're going to be doing some projects actually in these tents.